This program is brought to you from the Margaret Farrow Studio.
Hello and welcome to Newsmakers. I'm your host, Lisa Pugh. Wisconsin State Supreme Court isn't in session but is already making headlines just after the swearing-in of its newest member, Liberal Justice Janet Protasiewicz. Court experts have been predicting a heated session this year as they've already taken on they're expected to take on controversial issues like legislative redistricting, and also the justices have been issuing sparring statements over the past several days. Here to help us make sense of it all are Dustin Brown, Faculty of Research, Legal Research and Writing at the University of Wisconsin Law School, and Professor of History, Alan Ball from Marquette University. Thank you to you both.
Thank you so much. Great to be here.
So I know we've been hearing since that April election, you were here with us talking about that April election, that we could expect some changes in the direction of the court as they shifted their ideological balance. Sure seems within the last week that we're already seeing signs of that. What's really surprised you most about the last several days?
So the redistricting lawsuit that was filed this past week, that was something that everybody was expecting.
Right.
What I wasn't expecting, and I think most people probably weren't expecting, were these controversies over the firing of the director of state courts, and then after that, the controversy over the authority of the chief justice and changes that the liberal members of the court are making to the court's internal operating procedures and to the Supreme Court rules. So the fact that there was so much controversy out of the starting gate, that is something that surprised me.
Were you surprised by those developments as well?
Maybe the speed at which they occurred, but as far as the nature of some of them, maybe you'd expect them at some point down the road, but not immediately and all at once, perhaps. Yes.
Well, let's get into a little bit of the statements that the justices were making. Current Chief Justice Ann Ziegler issued a statement on August 2nd after that state court's director was fired by the new majority on their first day in power. She said, "To say that I am disappointed in my colleagues is an understatement. My colleagues' unprecedented, dangerous conduct is the raw exercise of overreaching power. It is shameful. I fear this is only the beginning." Now, since that statement, Justice Ziegler issued another on Friday, labeling the liberal court colleagues as rogue and saying they're attempting to gut her authority as Chief Justice. And then Justice Dallet responded, saying the Chief Justice has refused to meet. Professor Ball, you've studied the history of the court spanning several years. Have you ever witnessed a public sparring like this among justices?
Not specifically on these topics. There have been contentious moments in the past, such as when Justice Shirley Abramson was removed as Chief Justice. So you could go back and find bits of tension of this sort, but certainly on these issues, and you know, who knows how long it's going to go on, too, is another question. We don't know the end of it yet, but this could come to seem unprecedented, yes.
Dustin, we know the court has already accepted fewer cases for the upcoming session than they typically have in prior years. Is that a sign of a change in direction, or do you think that will also be changing soon?
You know, it's hard to tell. The court's docket is entirely discretionary, so the justices decide which cases to accept. And depending on the kinds of petitions that come before the court, it requires either three or four justices to agree to hear a particular case. And as you can imagine, there's a pipeline of cases. It takes some time between a party petitioning the court for review. It takes a while for the court to consider it. And then once it agrees to hear a case, it takes several months for that to be docketed. So typically there will be a pipeline of cases that are ready to be scheduled. Last year, before last term, at this point there were around 33 cases ready to be scheduled, ready to be argued. At this point, there's only six cases. The court has certainly been more selective in its review of cases. The last year, it accepted only about 5% of the petitions it considered, whereas the previous 2 years was more like 10%. But since this is based on individual votes of each justice, it's hard to draw some broad conclusion about what the court itself is doing, rather than their kind of, you know, separate decisions by each member of the court.
Really too early to tell if that means anything.
I will be curious to see what happens in the upcoming months as the court decides which additional cases to accept to hear in the coming term.
Professor Ball, I know I'm supposed to call you Alan. Yeah, I know you've been analyzing the state Supreme Court's justices' voting record spanning the 85 years. You have your Wisconsin Supreme Court statistics blog that many people look to. Would you say then that with this ideological shift, this is the most liberal court that Wisconsin has ever seen? Where do you go back and look at that history?
Well, that's an interesting question because we've seen this year, back in April, say, during the election campaign where Janet Protasiewicz defeated Dan Kelly, that headlines were often proclaiming this is, with her victory, we're now going to have the most liberal Supreme Court since 2007-8. We saw that again the past week when the court began its term, most liberal court since 2007-8. And I would suggest that that's an understatement, that this is likely to be the most liberal court we've ever seen, and here's why. The reason they picked 2007-8 is because that was the last year on the court of Justice Lewis Butler, who is regarded as a liberal, and he, along with two other justices regarded as liberals, Justice Shirley Abramson and Ann Welsh Bradley, are three liberals. They voted together fairly often, something like 61% of the time in non-unanimous decisions. But in order to prevail, to win, they needed a fourth vote, and there just wasn't one. The closest thing to a fourth vote was Justice Crooks, who only sided with them in 44% of non-unanimous decisions, which is less frequently than he sided with the conservatives at that time. So it's kind of a stretch to regard that court as liberal at all. I think the reason it came to seem liberal is because of what the court became subsequently when Justice Gableman defeated Butler and then Rebecca Bradley replaced Crooks and so forth, and Dan Kelly then replaced Prosser. That court came to seem so much more conservative that this one seemed liberal. But if we compare that Butler court with what we've had recently, in the past 3 years, again, we've had three liberals, that Ann Welsh Bradley, Dalit, and Krovsky, and they have voted together in non-unanimous decisions something like 78% of the time, which is more cohesively than the three during the Butler years. And more importantly, I think now it's almost certain that Janet Protasiewicz is going to side with them much more often than 44% of the time, which is what Justice Crook sided with the three liberals back then. So that's what prompts me to think that this coming court is going to be not only more liberal than the 2007-8 court, but the most liberal court we've seen in recent memory.
Dustin, the media likes to label justices as being part of the liberal ring, the wing, or conservative wing. Mm-hmm. Are those labels accurate?
I think those labels are accurate, but they don't present a complete picture for the reasons that Alan was explaining. The justices, whether liberal or conservative, they're not monolithic blocks. They don't always vote together. And so they really represent more of a spectrum. If you look at this past term, Justice Hagedorn, he continued to be a swing vote, but he was in the majority in the same number of cases as Justice Karofsky. Both of them, I think, were in the majority for 41 out of 45 cases. So both of them kind of represent the center of the court, Justice Hagedorn being center right and Justice Karofsky being center left, even though, Justice Hagedorn, we see as a judicial conservative and Justice Karofsky we see as more liberal. And then otherwise, the rest of the justices, they do fall into a more of a continuum, more of a spectrum, where if you look at the individual votes and cases, there are circumstances for nearly every one of the justices from this past term where they've crossed lines and they've sided with a justice either, in a majority or kind of joining a particular opinion that you might not have expected them to do.
Well, let's look at the data from the most recent state Supreme Court session. This chart that we're showing displays how frequently each justice voted in the majority, Dustin, like you said, during the 2022-23 term on cases decided by split votes. The data based on 45 decisions made between September 1st, 2022 and the end of the court's term just last month. In non-unanimous rulings, Justice Karofsky from the liberal wing and Hagedorn from the conservative conservative wing were each in the majority 86% of the time. In fact, Justice Hagedorn sided most often with Krofsky throughout the term, 82% of the time, and agreed least with his conservative counterpart, Justice Rebecca Bradley, at 67%. As you referenced, Dustin, Justice Hagedorn has been called that swing vote on the court. With the new ideological balance, do we expect that he would continue in that role, or might the more liberal justices say, well, we don't need that vote?
Well, that's a very interesting question, Lisa. It's one I've been wondering about myself. And I think the reason I'm wondering is that if we look at the 4 years that Justice Hagedorn has been on the court, he's now starting his fifth term, the trajectory of his influence in contentious decisions, say in 4-3 decisions, is very interesting. When he first arrived on the court in 2019-20, the conservatives didn't need him to win. That there were three conservatives, Rogan Sacks-Eagler and Dan Kelly, who voted together almost all the time, 97% of the time in 4-3 decisions. And so they only needed one more vote to win, and they had a choice of either Rebecca Bradley or Hagedorn. And thus, Hagedorn wasn't essential, and he appeared in 4-3 majorities only 30-some percent of the time in his first year. But the next year, the court changed when Dan Kelly was defeated by Jill Karofsky. Now the court assumed what it had would have for the next three terms, which is three conservatives, if we can use that label, and three liberals. And both of those trios voted together almost all the time in 4-3 decisions. But of course, neither could win. They needed a fourth vote. And there was only one person left who could be that fourth vote, and that was Justice Hagedorn. And so in his second term, rather than being in the majority in 4-3 decisions only 30-some percent of the time, now he was in the majority 80-some percent of the time, far more often than any other justice, which remained the case in his third term as well. Once we get to the fourth term, the term that's just ended, he was still very important in 4-3 majorities, I think 71% or so in 4-3 majorities. But by this time, the influence of what we're calling the liberals had reached the point where, as Dustin mentioned, Anne Welsh Bradley and Dalit were also voting 71% of the time in 4-3 majorities, and Jill Karofsky even more, 79%. So
we don't know.
Well, I mean, it raises the question of, well, what now? You know, what's going to happen? And I could imagine kind of a spectrum of possibilities. One is that we now have four liberals with Janet Protasiewicz, and they might conclude, as you suggested, well, we don't need Hagedorn anymore. We can win 4-3. We can get whatever we want without him. And if that happened, then we might return to basically what we had with Hagedorn's first term, where the conservatives, in effect, didn't need him. And he was only in the majority 30-some percent of the time. That could happen, going from, say, 80 or 70% to the majority down to some much lower number. On the other hand, the other end of the possible spectrum is the liberals might conclude, well, you know, we'd still like to try to accommodate him, find some common ground. We've been increasingly effective at doing that over the past few terms, to the point where in this most recent term he sided with them in 70% of the 4-3 majorities he cast. The liberals might think, well, in a way to try to protect ourselves from charges of being a partisan court or politicized court, it would look a lot better if we prevailed 5-2 rather than 4-3 with Hagedorn. So maybe we try to accommodate him. And so it will be interesting to see.
So much mystery here. We also don't know for sure how Justice Protasiewicz will vote. Is that correct?
Exactly. We have no idea. You know, it's difficult to parse her record as a circuit court judge in Milwaukee to predict what she would do as a justice on the Wisconsin Supreme Court, because they're just simply very different roles, where the Supreme Court is making law, it's deciding questions that haven't been decided before, very contentious questions, whereas as a judge on the Milwaukee Circuit Court, she was applying law that had already been, you know, handed down by the Wisconsin Supreme Court and other higher courts. So it's difficult to say where exactly in that spectrum she would fall.
I know nearly everyone watching the court had predicted that a redistricting challenge would be among the first cases filed with the court. Sure enough, that happened Wednesday. I think there was another challenge to the maps issued on Friday. Mm-hmm. So now two cases potentially that the court could take up. The petitioners in the first case say they're asking state constitutional questions that have never been asked before. Can you help us understand what is being asked this time that hasn't been before the court?
Yes, absolutely. These are sort of original claims because this is the posture of this case is very different than the posture of cases we've seen before. In recent decades, federal courts had heard redistricting disputes, but federal courts are in terms of the question of partisan gerrymandering, that's a question that federal courts are no longer adjudicating because the U.S. Supreme Court has held that that's a political question that's not justiciable, that's not something that can be heard under the federal constitution. So we're seeing in a lot of states challenges to maps going to the state courts. And the Wisconsin Supreme Court did hear a case, that was started just about 2 years ago, the Johnson case. But that case was in an extremely different posture because at that point, we had no maps. Every decade, you have to input new maps in place because there's a constitutional imperative under the U.S. Constitution, one person, one vote. Each district, each legislative district and congressional district has to have the same population. And there was an impasse where the legislature had adopted maps that the governor vetoed, so we had no maps. So then the Wisconsin Supreme Court had to start from scratch and create maps. Now this is very different because the plaintiffs are actually challenging the maps that the legislature had approved and the governor vetoed, and then subsequently that the Supreme Court put in place. And so they're basically making three claims under the Constitution. One is a partisan gerrymandering claim, saying that it's just unfair and it violates equal protection, free speech and assembly, and free government clauses to create maps that basically deprive Democrats of the opportunity to ever possibly get a majority in the legislature. The other two claims, one is based on language in the state constitution that requires contiguous territory for state legislative districts, because these districts, the majority of them actually have little islands
that are
not connected to them. So based on the plain language of the state constitution, they violate that requirement for contiguity. And finally, there's a separation of powers argument based on the fact that the Wisconsin Supreme Court ultimately put in place the map that Governor Evers had vetoed. So the argument is that this is basically usurping both kind of, the governor's position since he had vetoed it, and the legislature is what can override a veto, but they failed to override the veto. So the Supreme Court can't step in and do that. That violates separation of powers principles. Those are the arguments.
Well, and this another thing that's interesting about this, it's an original action where it hasn't made its way through the lower courts. Is that something that's unique in terms of cases that often come before the state Supreme Court?
Unique that it's an original
action? It's an original action.
Not unique, that there have certainly been flurries of them, and not this past year, but in previous years, there have been an unusually large number of original actions, generally filed by conservative actors. Now, of course, it's liberal actors who are going to be filing these actions, but it's certainly not unique, no.
Not unique. So you mentioned that the U.S. Supreme Court had said there shouldn't be judicial intervention into legislative redistricting because it's a political process. That doesn't apply to the state Supreme Court?
That does not apply because the U.S. Supreme Court was talking about the federal constitution and federal constitutional standards. And the role of the U.S. Supreme Court and the role of state Supreme Courts is very different. And when the U.S. Supreme Court said that, they actually explicitly said that state constitutions are still available, state courts are still available. The U.S. Supreme Court wasn't condoning gerrymandering, but it said federal courts are not the place to go to police this. But it was basically an invitation to go to state courts and cite state constitutions. And although the U.S. Supreme Court in its decision had described this as a non-justiciable question, one that where it's too difficult to come up with a standard that you could apply to decide how much gerrymandering is too much, a standard has been created. Like that has been adopted. Litigants have advanced statistical standards that have been adopted by state courts. The dissent in that U.S. Supreme Court case kind of embraced the idea that there is, in fact, a standard that can be applied here. And so what the plaintiffs in this case are doing is asking the state Supreme Court to basically apply such a standard and find that these districts constitute a partisan gerrymander. But also the other two claims wouldn't require the court to find a partisan gerrymandering, the claim about contiguous districts and separation of powers. So there's kind of multiple avenues that the court could follow.
You know, it sounds like a pretty complicated case,
yes.
But yet the petitioners want new maps in place by March of 2024.
Yes.
Is that... There's with all of the power struggles that we're seeing in the court, is it conceivable that there could be new maps by that date?
It is conceivable because this is it's a fast timeline. It's fast for courts in general, but courts are accustomed to managing redistricting cases on timelines like this. The Wisconsin Supreme Court did exactly this 2 years ago when a case was initiated in August or September, and then maps were in place by April. Federal courts that have litigated these questions have done this before in Wisconsin. You know, basically every decade there have been redistricting cases, and this timeline has always been met. So I certainly think it is feasible for the Wisconsin Supreme Court to resolve this case and to you know, provide for new maps in time for the 2024 elections.
March of next year. The state Supreme Court ordered a least change approach in Wisconsin's maps when they had this case before them in 2022, setting what's called a precedent. Mm-hmm. And this would this be somewhat overturning a precedent? How often does the Supreme Court actually overturn a precedent?
Mm. Okay. Yeah, sure. This gets into the question of stare decisis, is a Latin phrase, meaning basically that once a precedent has been set, once a decision has been made, it's important to stick to it. Otherwise, you have chaos, anarchy, if people think that the law could change dramatically, frequently, capriciously, that what's the point of even trying to pretend you have a rule of law? So that's an important legal principle. On the other hand, pretty much all justices would agree that not only is stare decisis important, but that there are individual laws that simply do need to be changed or decisions that need to be overturned.
And this one is only 2 years
mm-hmm,
old.
Mm-hmm. And it will be interesting to see how that goes, because in recent years, when the conservatives dominated the court and set off on the course they wanted to follow, it was the liberal minority, say Justice Abramson or Ann Walsh Bradley, who cried stare decisis. We've done this for a long time in the past. You can't simply change. And the conservatives, they would either just ignore them or say, no, there are certain exceptions that apply when stare decisis should not be adhered to. Now, with potentially a liberal majority, which is likely, I would think, to try to revisit some of the decisions in the past, say that have to do with maybe Act 10 or voter ID, or is it okay to carry guns on city buses, you know, things like that that the court has ruled on. Now, I would be willing to bet that it will be the conservatives who argue stare decisis, no, we've already decided this, you can't go there.
That's a term we should be
right?
listening
yeah.
for.
And if I could just add something to that. So even, you know, within the bounds of stare decisis, previous cases can be distinguished. You know, just because the court has previously said something doesn't necessarily mean that that's going to be binding precedent going ahead. And in terms of the least change standard, you know, this is an argument that the plaintiffs have confronted, where they've basically said, you know, acknowledging that this was the approach that the Supreme Court had applied before, but this is just a very different circumstance for some of the reasons that I explained before, where the posture of this case is different. You know, the claims themselves, they allege that the districts are unconstitutional. So it wouldn't make sense if the districts are unconstitutional to follow a least change approach, saying that we're going to stick as close to these unconstitutional districts.
It was flawed from the beginning.
Exactly, as we can. And there are also kind of other critiques that they had of the least change approach. So it's not necessarily overruling precedent. It could be a distinguishing precedent.
You know, Dustin, you had written recently that the court's debate over constitutional interpretation would foreshadow the coming term, particularly when they consider the legality of partisan gerrymandering. Mm-hmm. What does that mean?
So that means that since partisan gerrymandering raises constitutional questions, as do all the claims in this case, the court's approach to interpreting the Constitution is going to be significant in how it ultimately resolves the case. And there were a couple of cases in the last term where Justice Hagedorn and Justice Dalit had basically debated their approaches to constitutional interpretation, where Justice Hagedorn tried to make a case for the fact that the court has always applied the original public meaning of the Constitution, trying to conclude what the Constitution meant at the time that that provision was adopted, or if it's an amendment, at the time that that amendment was adopted. And Justice Dalit was arguing for just a much more expansive approach to constitutional interpretation, one that looks it certainly includes original meaning, but also goes beyond that. And it seemed clear looking at that extensive discussion in those cases that this was a debate that was really foreshadowing a discussion that would become more meaningful in this term.
So listen for stare decisis and constitutional interpretation throughout this session. Good to know. Another case people will be watching for is the abortion case, challenging Wisconsin's 1849 abortion ban. Will that be taken up in the next year? When can we expect that to be resolved?
It's impossible to know when the court would take up that abortion case. To just quickly cover the history, that case challenging the courts to the state's abortion ban, that was filed more than a year ago in June of 2022. And in the trial court just last month issued a decision on a motion to dismiss, denying the motion to dismiss and basically saying this case can continue, this challenge to the abortion law can continue. But I believe today, actually, the plaintiffs are expected to file briefs that will address really kind of the main arguments left in the case. And then the briefing schedule would have all that briefing concluded by mid-September. So at that point, if the party's representation of how quickly the court could resolve this is accurate, it's just a matter of the judge resolving the case and issuing the decision. And then after that, that would typically be too late for the court for a case to make it up to the Wisconsin Supreme Court within that same term. But there are ways to expedite. An appeal could bypass.
You think there'll be a desire by the plaintiffs to get it to the state Supreme Court?
Yes, I certainly do, in order to have some finality over the question of whether abortion is in fact legal in Wisconsin. Some of the plaintiffs in the case are doctors, who are saying we're unable to perform this procedure. So there's a possibility that if everything falls into place and all the steps to expedite happen, the Supreme Court could hear it by the end of this term in the spring of 2024. But that's it's impossible to say, and that would be a very aggressive timeline.
And a very busy year for the court. we've been talking about redistricting, abortion. Those are the issues getting the headlines. But there are several other cases on the calendar for September, particularly two that are scheduled. Can you summarize for us both an adoption case and a case involving Catholic Charities?
Yes, and I'm glad you brought this up because The political cases, the cases that stir these controversies, they tend to dominate the headlines. But the everyday work of the Wisconsin Supreme Court is construing laws and applying law to particular facts and really kind of, creating clarity for the people of Wisconsin about what the law means. And that's true in these two cases that are going to be argued on September 11th. The first concerns step-parent adoption. It's AMB versus Circuit Court for Ashland County. And under Wisconsin statute, a spouse is allowed to adopt a spouse's child as a second parent, but an unmarried partner of a parent cannot adopt their partner's child. In this case, the plaintiff had raised his partner's child from, I think, about the age of two for many years, but he and his partner are not married, and he wants to adopt as a second parent. But the plain language of the statute simply doesn't allow that. So he's bringing constitutional claims both on his behalf, and he's also raising them on behalf of the child for why this statutory scheme should be overturned and adoption in this context should be allowed. The second case that will be argued on that first day is Catholic Charities versus Labor and Industry Review Commission. And that case asks whether some organizations that are under the umbrella of Catholic Charities, whether they qualify for an exemption from the unemployment insurance program that covers charities that are operated primarily for religious purposes. So if a charity is primarily religious, then it gets this exemption and it can opt out of the unemployment insurance program. The Court of Appeals heard this case and concluded no. You know, these particular charities under the Catholic Charities umbrella do not qualify. But this raises some First Amendment questions. There are a lot of religious entities that have filed amicus briefs in the case. So I think this is something certainly to watch in the coming term.
A lot of parties watching that throughout the state.
Exactly.
Well, speaking of something that a lot of people will be watching, there is going to be another state Supreme Court election in 2 years with longtime Liberal Justice Anne Walsh Bradley seeking a fourth 10-year term, 2025. I know we saw a change in the last election with Justice Protasiewicz sharing some personal views. Mm-hmm. Why was that a big change? Will we see probably more of that in coming elections, would you say?
Well, it's possible if future participants in the elections conclude that it worked this time around. That is, that rather than say as little as possible about your views, I'm in favor of rule of law or something that, you know, any justice or potential justice could say, that you try to be more specific about your position on one thing or another, that if it was that was successful, it worked, then I could imagine elections becoming more specific in the views of the justices, but or the potential justices. It will be interesting to see, because normally, as I say, when, say, a U.S. Supreme Court justice is trying to be confirmed by the Senate, or when someone's running here, it's always say as little as possible, you know, don't make it clear what you actually believe. And so that was different this time, yes.
This last election set records in spending. It was quite heated. Mm-hmm. Would you expect more of the same in 2025? Because that ideological balance will, again, be on the ballot.
Exactly. The ideological balance will be on the ballot because it's Justice Anne Walsh Bradley, who's the person with the longest tenure on the court, who will be seeking a fourth term. Incumbents generally fare very well in Wisconsin's Supreme Court elections. The most recent elections that we've had, I think actually the four most recent elections, you know, those are new justices that came onto the court. So I think that the scenario will be a little different for an incumbent who has a record to point to rather than somebody trying to introduce them to the people. That's the only factor that I think could, you know, temper this, you know, hyper, you know, just kind of the rhetoric that we're seeing in these cases. But it seems that given the importance of the Wisconsin Supreme Court and the funding that's poured into these cases, it's possible we could see more of the same.
More of the same. Well, thank you both for sharing your knowledge and expertise with us today. We appreciate it. We know that you'll be watching the court this fall. A reminder to our viewers that the session opens on September 11th. You can see oral arguments live right here on Wisconsin Eye. You can also rewatch sessions of the court in our video archive. And thank you to our viewers for watching. Be sure to tune in again as we highlight the issues and sit down with the decision makers who make a difference for all of us.
This program is a production of Wisconsin Eye, an independent, nonpartisan, nonprofit media network with a mission to inform, educate, and engage the citizens of Wisconsin. Wisconsin Eye is the nation's first and only independently funded state civic broadcast network, providing gavel-to-gavel access to government proceedings and events at the state capitol.